Everybody wants to succeed at what they do, but not everyone does. We watch the superachievers on TV or read about them in the papers and wonder how they do it. This hour, our guests unlock some of the secrets of high superachievers so the rest of us can put them into play. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert. Glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are Camille Sweeney, a journalist and a McDowell Arts Colony Fellow, and Josh Gosfield, an award-winning illustrator and fine artist and former art director at New York Magazine. Well, together they co-authored the book, The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. And we want to know who you look to as the epitome of success and what secrets have you uncovered for yourself at being the best. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also check in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Camille and Josh, welcome.
Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning, Veronica.
So this must have been an amazing book to write. You describe it yourselves as going to the coolest dinner party ever. But you know, what was it actually like to sit down and talk with some of our culture's most inspiring, high-achieving people? What was that like?
We kind of fell in love with each person that we spoke to. You know, we might be researching them for an entire week, and then there's the build-up, the excitement of the interviews about to happen. And then as the interview is occurring, we're really trying to uncover what is most unique about the person. So there's a high level of high wire walking and excitement as the interviews progressed.
Right.
And then we'd get to the end and just sort of look at each other in amazement at the material we had just gotten from each person.
Wow. It was kind of like serial dating. That's what I thought of it as. We kept collecting these people and their stories and their backgrounds. It was amazing.
Well, Camille, at the heart of it, why don't you try to flesh out what exactly it was you were trying to tease out of these people?
We were talking to these people who not only excel at what they do, but who have elevated what they do to an art form. And so we were always looking for the Picassos or the Warhols of any given field and talking to them about their principles and strategies and techniques for how they're achieving these amazing feats.
And the goal was always to really find out, we didn't have an agenda, so it was to find out what exactly is it about this person that allowed them to achieve the goals that they have reached.
It's interesting because you hear a lot about that and what it takes to create success or that sort of genius level. Some people say it's just tons and tons of practice. And there's always been this belief that it's sort of this thing you can't really put your finger on, that either you've got it or you don't. But it sounds like when you guys were done with this book, there were some qualities that emerged that were really important to these people's success.
Absolutely. I mean, we kind of thought of it as, you know, although the superachievers were so highly individual, when after speaking with them, we realized that they share many traits that have led to their success. Things like in our intro, we talk about the 10 most important ones that we found. Things like dedication, what we call intelligent persistence, building a community, telling a story, managing emotions, having patience, a very active form of listening, and then happiness was actually a big component of success as well.
That's a funny one. But in terms of, you know, these qualities that you just listed, I'm assuming that these people didn't have all of them. Maybe they just sort of brought one really to the fore and worked on that.
It was pretty amazing how synergistic these people were. Maybe not every single person we interviewed embodied all of these traits. But by and large, what we found was that these people, you know, there wasn't the person who just got everything by dedication. There wasn't the person who got everything by listening. They really needed to practice as many of these positive traits as possible. And after writing the book, we ourselves learn so much from them that we kind of recognize how important each one of these things are. Like, I know for me, we just had a book release party, and I got a little bit out of shape, and, you know, this question of managing my emotions, I was witnessing myself not managing my emotions well and witnessing how it made me a little less effective. And it was so great having done the book that I was much more aware of it. But one of the hardest things is to apply it after the awareness. And I think one thing that the people have is that they understand holistically all of these things, but they also have the mental fortitude to continue to apply them to their work.
Well, I want to talk about that self-awareness component. But Josh, why did you get bent out of shape at your own book party?
I think it's just the stress of us handling so many things at the same time, because it wasn't just a book release party. It's all the aspects of writing a book, which it's our first book, so we've had to learn from soup to nuts all the things that are required in writing a book, and there's a lot more than just writing a book. And it's, you know, at times it can just be overwhelming with all the things that we are managing at the same time.
We had a lot of people coming. There was a bookstore that was selling the books within the party, and a lot of players were there.
And then all the things we had to do in the next day.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, well, I can only imagine, but it sounds. I want to talk about David Chang, because he is one of the people you interviewed who really epitomized the self-awareness quality, which is really one of the key that you look at. This is one that you find one of the most crucial. Tell us about David Chang, Camille.
David Chang is a fascinating guy, a young guy. When he was in his 20s, he went to Japan and he made a hobby of finding the best bowl of noodles. And he came back, he went to culinary school, he started working in the finest restaurants in New York. He worked his way up. And at a certain point, he asked himself, what do I really want to do? And it turned out what he really wanted to do was make a tiny little restaurant, a noodle bar, where he could make this humble bowl of noodles with 4-star chef technique. So he opened up a noodle bar, and he was not doing well. And
he was working incredibly hard.
18-hour days and kept, was angry at his staff all the time, so he kept losing staff and While the bowl of noodles, the soup was fantastic, he wasn't able to. It seemed unsustainable. And rather than just make sort of a minor tweak to the menu or try to work harder, which probably would have been impossible, he had this sort of self-examination moment where he looked at his assumption that he could actually be economically viable just with the bowl of noodles. And so he and his chefs went to the Green Market, and they got so inspired by everything that was there and went back and just started cooking these unbelievable culinary mashups. And they all of a sudden the crowd started coming, then the critics started coming, then the awards piled up. And now he owns 8 restaurants in Australia, as well as up in Canada and here in New York. And he has a magazine and a TV show, and he's just his thing has exploded because of this decision that he made. So
basically, he had to throw out his assumptions about what this noodle shop could be and sort of look at it really unflinchingly.
Absolutely, absolutely,
and
it's something.
Go ahead.
Well, it's something that we saw that a lot of the 36 people that we talked to, these super achievers, they are skilled at that. It's something that they do, and we're all faced with obstacles, but it's kind of how you get over those obstacles, how you get through failure that distinguishes these super achievers.
Very often the default will be, well, this isn't working because people don't get it. I'm ahead of my time. My boss is an idiot. The people working for me are no good. The economy's bad. And it's the people who are really able to take a hard look at what they might have done wrong, their possible biases and assumptions, and look at them really carefully, and then formulate a new plan, and then continue to be self-aware and watch what the results are of their new methodology.
And so you're saying that a lot of us, you know, the average Joe or Jane on the street is going to look for the externals, look anywhere but sort of at themselves. And it takes someone who's willing to look at themselves and make those hard calls.
Absolutely.
I think it's the human quality is it's sometimes difficult to take responsibility for failure.
Well, someone else you write about is a fascinating example, because talk about your high-pressure situations. Gary Noesner, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, chief hostage negotiator for the FBI. He's another profile in your book. Tell us about what he went through.
What was so fascinating about Gary was, although he was dealing with homicidal perpetrators who were putting the lives of innocent people at risk, the practice that he found most important was managing his emotions. Well, managing actually not just the emotions of himself, but managing the emotions of his perpetrators and also the tactical portion of the police force, because the tactical squads had a much more gung-ho attitude. They just wanted to go in and take out the guy. And in some cases, the conditions might not really be correct, and you could possibly have the loss of innocent life. So Gary could be dealing with this guy who was threatening to take other people out, and his goal has to be to, first of all, establish a rapport with the guy, and then actually almost as a therapist, help this guy understand what his problem is, and then help formulate some sort of solution to his problem, in which case then they can begin to start an actual negotiation that might lead to a conclusion that does not end with the loss of innocent life.
So his main objective, he told us, was to stay calm enough to help that irrational perpetrator figure out his emotional needs.
And after we talked to him, this is one of these moments where we would just look at each other and think, my God, you know, we might be writing a book. That's a great thing. But here's a guy who goes to work every day, and the stakes of what he does, if he excels or doesn't excel, the stakes are life or death.
Can you take us through one of those cases where he had to put all that into play?
Well, there was an interesting one that actually he wasn't a part of, but
Well, there was one you're thinking about, the one on the train?
Was a fascinating one on a train, which was actually almost a counterintuitive one where the
perpetrator had taken hostage his own sister and her children
on the train,
on an Amtrak train.
Yeah, and the guy, they really could not get through to the guy, and he was working with a Spanish speaking man because the hostage taker was Spanish,
right?
And there was the death of one of the children. And the guy that Gary worked with was so involved in it. He actually did something that Gary said you should never do, which was he went up to the car.
They both went up.
They both went up to the car, actually with a gun hidden, and demanded that the man handed over
the four-year-old child.
And it was actually a case that Gary talked about in which he said, you know, don't ever take any risks that you shouldn't.
That the negotiators themselves shouldn't be taking the risks. But this was a situation that was so it called for this kind of action, he felt. But again, he kept very calm. He followed his colleague up, so he was right behind him. Could have been blown away, but they were able to get the guy to hand over the girl. And eventually, I think his sister was allowed out as well. So even though they had one loss of life, they saved the other two. Yeah.
And there was other examples of, he said, you know, sometimes you actually have to take the guy out, although his goal is always to save lives, even of the perpetrator. You know, he recognizes that there is moments where you have to take the ultimate step.
That sounds so hard, though. I mean, this is an example of managing your emotions. And that's something that a lot of people work on their entire lives with the help of therapists. So what are some things that, you know, the average person can do to try to learn to manage their emotions to be more successful?
We had a really interesting conversation. One of the youngest, I think she actually is the youngest person in our book. She was, it's a young girl by the name of Jessica Watson, who is a solo circumnavigator, which means someone who sails around the world. And she was 11 when she got this inspiration and to make this trip. And so she went off on her own. She planned the whole thing. And when she was 16, she went off on her own on this journey. And she talked to us about managing her emotions. And her line to us, which was, it's stuck in my head, was, you can't always change the conditions, but you can change how you deal with them. And I always think of her out in the middle of the ocean with her boat turned over, flipped over in these giant waves. And thinking that way, and as we were putting together this book, I would often think about her line, and I think it's just the awareness of the emotions and that you do have control over them that really can help.
We sometimes think of emotions as these alien forces that overtake us. So I think the first step is to be aware of them and then to work with them. And interestingly, we found in some cases where people were actually even able to channel emotions that we might think of as negative to help them in pursuit of their goals. Philippe Petit and even David Chang were examples. Philippe Petit, the man who walked across the World Trade Center, were examples of people who often use frustration and anger to motivate themselves forward. That's that kind of like, I'm going to show everybody else what I'm going to do.
Yeah, they're interesting examples. I mean, and Philippe Petit thought that everyone else tried to make it look hard, and he was going to make it look easy and effortless.
Yeah, that's what he...
And he did.
And yes. He did. Yeah. He told us he wanted to be a poet in the sky and make the wire disappear so that you were just seeing this dancer up in the sky.
Philippe had seen wire walkers when he was a kid at the circus, and he felt what they were trying to tell the audience was, this is so hard, you will never be able to do it. Aren't I amazing? He didn't like that.
Yeah.
So Philippe's idea was, I want to write poetry in the sky. He wanted to make it look effortless. And that's, you know, when we talked about what we wanted to do, was the book is called The Art of Doing. And we really wanted to find these sort of people who elevated what they did into an art form.
Well, we're talking this hour with our guest Camille Sweeney, a journalist, Anna McDowell Arts Colony Fellow, and Josh Gosfield, an award-winning illustrator and fine artist and former art director at New York Magazine. We're talking about the book they co-authored called The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. And we're looking to hear from you this hour as well. Who do you look up to as sort of the epitome of what success is? Who inspires you? And are there tricks of the trade that you've learned yourself about how to be the best and how to bring out the best in yourself? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about the art of success with our guests Camille Sweeney and Josh Gosfield. They've co-authored a book called The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. And they've compiled interviews with superachievers in our culture. And we just talked about Jessica Watson, who was the 11-year-old who circumnavigated the globe on a solo sailing trip. And we have a little clip from her. Let's take a listen.
You're 16 years of age, and I am so struck by your composure. Confidence, yes, to do the job at hand, and you succeeded. But where does that come from?
Good question, I suppose. It comes from, you know, overcoming little challenges, and each challenge, your parents give you the freedom to do little things, have little adventures, and you take them on, and you do well, and then you move on to something bigger, and it's just
small steps lead to big dreams. Well, your mum told me earlier in the week that you really didn't seriously start sailing until you were 10 or 11. That's about 5 years ago. You've been doing a lot.
Yeah, and a lot's happened in that amount of time. And to be honest, when I first started sailing, I was terrified of it. I wasn't thrilled by the whole idea. It was just really quite scary. And it's amazing, you know, I stuck to it, and now I love it.
And a clip there from Jessica Watson, who is one of the guests in the book who really inspired the two of you. What about her small step thing? Did that come up a lot?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, one thing that we found is that every success might begin with an inspiration, but not every inspiration is going to lead to a success. So what is the difference? First of all, if somebody has a dream of something, they've got to, you know, pick up the pen, pick up the guitar, like Jessica Watson. They've got to get in the boat. They've got to learn how to sail. And then beyond that, it's really a day-to-day, a week-to-week, a year-to-year struggle to move forward in pursuit of your goals. And, you know, one aspect we talk about is happiness, which sort of the flip side is passion. It's really important that you actually love what you do so much or are so passionate about what you do, because you're going to just meet so many obstacles and detours along the way. And if you don't have the really strong connection with the dream, there's a very good chance that you're going to tail off. I mean, we sort of say, if you look at your dream and then you look at how committed you are to your dream, you probably have a good sense of the possible range of success you might get.
Well, we're going to go to a caller next. And if you would like to call up and share your story, we'd love to hear you. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And Eugene in Viola is on the air. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning. Good morning, Veronica.
Morning.
To your guests. Over a lifetime, I found two things that worked, and I'm 74. And that is the persistence and unorthodox. I quit high school when I was 16, and I had a year and a half of high school, and I had a dream I wanted to teach school. Eventually, I went to work in assembly plant nights, went to high school days, finished that high school, finished my college, and I put in 27 years in a classroom. And unorthodox, I bought a 13-room home for $500 down and didn't have the $500. And I had to figure out how to get the $500, and I did, and I paid for the place in a few years.
Wow.
But I've tried the unorthodox over the years, and I love it sometimes, even if it doesn't work. I have learned from my mistakes, and when I was growing up right after the war, our mother never told us it wouldn't work, never told us we failed. And that was the big thing with all three of us. And as a result, all three of us have tried anything just to see what kind of results we'll get on a situation. But persistence, you've got to be willing to stay with it.
Right. Those are great examples. Thank you so much for calling, Eugene. So persistence and being unorthodox. I think another way to say it is kind of having chutzpah to try stuff and not be afraid of failure. I imagine that had to have come up.
That came up a lot. And one guy that we talked to, Ken Jennings, was so interesting because he was a brainiac, and he was a big Jeopardy trivia nerd.
His fantasy was to be on Jeopardy.
Right.
But he he lived life, he raised a family, he had a career as a computer programmer, and it really wasn't until he was 30 that he actually got up the nerve to get on to Jeopardy.
And to go down to L.A.
To go for an audition.
To an audition. And yeah. Once he got there, he said that everybody there was the smartest person in the room, so he didn't have high hopes that he would actually get on. But they did call him back, and he did get on. And he won the first game, and he won again, and he kept winning and winning and winning, and he became the Jeopardy champion of all time. He won, I think, it's 74 games in a row.
Yeah, so it's an interesting example of what the gentleman who just called in. It took Ken Jennings a long time to take action on his dream, but when he took action, that if you don't take that first step, nothing is ever going to happen. And what the gentleman said about buying the home, it might have been a fantasy. There's this 13-room house. It's really great. I don't have the $500. And that's the end of the dream.
And you call Ken Jennings, an example of happiness. Well, he kept winning, which is bound to make you happy. But can you talk a little bit more about how happiness comes into play?
Well, his story was so interesting because he realized that as he was winning on Jeopardy and he played so many games, he considered it a job. And it was the first time that he was actually happy on his job. And that happiness sort of propelled him to another passion of his, which is writing. And he said through his game playing on Jeopardy, he was able to get the courage to take that next step and become a writer, quit his computer programming job and become a writer. And he's now written a number of books.
Another example we love is the seminal funk master, George Clinton, of the band's Parliament Funkadelic. And he says, I'm not interested in happiness. I'm interested in the pursuit of happiness. And what he uses is this idea of happiness, in a way almost when we talked about anger, as a motivation to go forward. He always feels like his greatest album is in front of him, even though he's 70. And is just an icon of American music, has been involved in everything from doo-wop to hip-hop. So that can be a very interesting relationship with happiness.
Yeah, that's such a great quote because really, pursuing happiness is active. And maybe when you've achieved it, it's more of a static thing. But most of us are happy when we're in motion.
It's exactly. Really true, and that's another thing we found with these people is none of them told us, well, I pretty much accomplished my goals, and now I'm going to go sit on my couch and watch a lot of TV.
Right. So it's good to have a goal that's, shining before you that you can keep moving toward.
And to move forward, have that goal be flexible, and then possibly when you accomplish that goal, you want to go chase another goal.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Dick on the line from Bark River, Michigan. Hi, Dick.
Hello again. My point was going to be being the best usually involves competition with others, and basically it involves a very competitive to win. You have to bend the rules. But one more comment. I remember Ken Jennings on Jeopardy.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And he answered a question correctly, but he was smarter than the question makers. The answer was Brussels, Belgium. And he said Bruxelles, the French pronunciation. Mm-hmm. And they didn't give him points.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the rule makers, but bending the rules or a sense of self-shame if you don't do your best helps you. Be better. Thank you.
Right. Those are interesting ones. Thank you, Dick. And Ken Jennings, he prepared really hard, too. So there's that determination and willpower again as well. I don't know. What do you make of what Dick said there, Camille?
Well, Ken Jennings had a great preparation story where he was in his living room before he got this call back and he had the 3 weeks and he would stand at his recliner with his child's Fisher-Price stack toy watching Jeopardy over and over again and practicing. But he's an interesting case, and I think that's true that you do need to figure out who you're playing against. And that idea that Dick brought up of who are you in competition with? We had another really interesting conversation with Martina Navratilova, who's the tennis player from the 70s and 80s, and she played into the 90s too.
She was fiercely competitive. And, I mean, it's a little bit of a self-awareness story where she was doing incredibly well as a tennis player and kind of bouncing back and forth between one and two with Chris Evert. And, I mean, in a way, maybe what the gentleman said, because she was so competitive after this very galling loss to Chris Evert, kind of tap into self-awareness here, but she might have been motivated by the fact that this loss was just kind of unbearable to her. It was then that she started really questioning her assumptions, which were basically that she could win on talent and instinct alone. And what she did from that moment on over the years was revamp one aspect of her game after another, beginning first with her physical training. She was the first person in tennis to go through the kind of rigorous physical training that's just completely typical now, but it was her tactical game, it was her relationship to her emotions, it was her strategic game, it was her diet. So she had the competitive spirit that would drive her forward to make all these changes.
And then she dominated tennis, women's tennis, for years after that.
And so she had to be willing, you know, kind of like David Chang, to just sort of scrap everything, throw everything out the window and start over. I think that's kind of daunting, isn't it, when you've built something already and it's not quite where you want it to be, but to be able to just chuck it and start over.
You're just invested with all that cognitive history. You know, I was going forward and I was thinking this, and then you've got to be able to just basically rip the thing down and say, boy, maybe the goal isn't quite right. Maybe my approach to it isn't quite right. Maybe I missed some things in there that aren't quite right. But is the important thing holding on to what you believed before, or is the important thing the accomplishment of your goals?
We're talking this hour about the art of success with our guests Camille Sweeney and Josh Gosfield. They've co-authored a book called The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. We're taking a look at some of the incredible interviews that they did with people across the spectrum of superachievers, figuring out how they reached those goals and what qualities they had in common. And as maybe some of us are still hanging on to New Year's resolutions, well, we're kind of finding out what might help this hour and help in life in general. And we'd love to hear your stories about what's worked in your own life, what have you used and put to good effect, and who do you look up to when it comes to people who've really succeeded in life? Maybe someone in your own family, and maybe someone you've admired from afar. Well, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also decide to send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and hope you'll stick around for next hour when our guest says never look a polar bear in the eye. He took his family up to Churchill, Manitoba, the polar bear capital of the world, where he discovered some fascinating and uncomfortable facts about polar bears. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about the art of success with our guests Camille Sweeney and Josh Gosfield, who co-authored the book The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. And here's somebody everybody loves to talk about. Yogi Berra is someone you profile in your book, and one of the most successful catchers of all time. Also someone who's known for his wit and his wisdom. What is Yogi Berra's magic?
What we found most interesting about Yogi Berra was not only was he an incredible baseball player, but he was one of the rare ball players who actually made the teammates around him better. The catcher on a baseball team is the closest thing to a quarterback. They manage the pitcher, they call the pitches, and they position the fielders. And Yogi stressed with us how he felt the most important thing in the success of the Yankees, which he played for through the 40s, through the 60s, was teamwork. And I suppose the proof is in the pudding in that Yogi Berra holds the record for playing in more World Series championships than any other player. The guy was such a mensch and was such a support with his teammates. So we thought he was just a really wonderful example. And again, to go back to what the last gentleman said about competition, although competition is very important, it's also extremely important to build a community of people around you who share a stake in the achievement of your goals. In Yogi's case, it wasn't about people's personal records. It was about the success of the team.
So he had this great quote that he told us. He said, if teammates don't support teammates, then your team's in trouble.
Yeah, so that community that you were talking about, building that community, and other people have mentioned that as well in your book about getting people to sort of love your idea as much as you do, whether it's in an online community or in another way. How can we do that in our daily lives, do you think? It makes sense when you're on a baseball team. You know, you want the team to pull together. But what about if you're, I don't know, trying to shine at work?
We talked to one guy that we found fascinating, Guy Kawasaki, who's a business guru. And he was talking about community as an ecosystem. And it's made up of partners and friends, allies, evangelists that work with you and align themselves with your cause's success. And he gave examples of, you know, whether it's a rock band or a muffin store or a billion-dollar startup, that you have to rely on this community of people that you're reaching out to in order to be successful.
And Guy had a really interesting nuts and bolts kind of tip about asking for favors. He had this wonderful vignette about Ben Franklin, who had a political foe at the time, I believe in the Continental Congress. And what Ben Franklin did was he wrote an elaborate note to this fellow and said, I would like to borrow this very rare book of yours. He borrowed the book from him and then returned it with an effusive thank you note. And this guy not only became a political ally, but became a friend for life.
Hmm.
And we really took this story to heart. And, you know, both of us maybe had a little, before we began this project, had a little more pride and reluctance sometimes to ask people for help. And we found it's been really interesting to include our friends, associates, colleagues, people that are maybe removed a step or two and just say, hey, can you help us with this particular thing? And of course, the flip side of that is to do favors in return. And sometimes even the best favor is the one that's not even asked for.
And there's research, isn't there, that people like to help out because it feels good. So when you're asking someone for help, you're getting help, but you're also helping someone else feel good.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, we've just had an amazing experience with how many people have been involved in the success of this book.
The daunting task of putting the book together was getting all the people, and that was my job, was what we call wrangling the people. And one of the guys that we wanted to get was a billionaire who made a hedge funder who made $1 billion a year. And so I found out that the billionaire's wife was friends with a speech therapist who worked with the daughter of my sister's friend from high school.
So, talk like about your 20 degrees
right.
of separation.
And
yeah.
Everybody along the chain made the connection, which was fantastic.
Nice.
We didn't actually get the guy,
no.
But it's the kind of help that we reached out to do. I mean, had we been sitting in our little office studio at home writing this book without reaching out for the help of other people, the book would not be what it is.
Mm, yeah, so that reaching out to people and forming that network and that community again, I guess, that
yeah,
we grew
up
around this book.
It can be hard because there's a certain amount of rejection involved.
Right. And what about that? What about coping with failure, the times when you just, you know, you just crash and burn and it's a flame out? What about the lessons that these people have learned about coping with failure?
Well, we sort of feel about these people that they shape their lives around their inspiration rather than the other way around. And when you do that, when you are committed to your dream, you know, as we say, you're always going to get knocked down. And it's never going to stop the knocking down. It's not like you're going to reach some point and then now it's the glide path towards greater and greater success. And it's really that level of commitment to the dream is what's going to keep you going forward.
So that's why I guess you always hear you have to love what you do, because you're going to keep on doing it and you're going to take some hits for it too.
Absolutely. And that, and then that way you can be creative about how you get through the failure if you know that you're doing it no matter what.
I mean, another thing is that you can look at it sometimes failure as being almost fun, because it really shakes things up. It's entertainment. It's like a little bit of novelty. Okay, well, that didn't really work. So how are we going to go forward in a new and interesting way? I mean, for us, this book has been like a crash course in success. And we can't always even remember all of the tips and life strategies that we picked up from the people that we interviewed for this book. And we actually feel that any reader who comes to this book, they may pick up a whole different set of things than us. But we just think there's a so much material in there that can help anybody, regardless of what their goals are in life. You know, you may be, you know, you might be a homemaker, you might be a gardener, it might be about your hobbies, it might be about your personal life, and it might be about your work life. But there's so many things that people can do to radically improve what they are engaged in.
One that I found was really inspiring was Aaron Gruel, who's a teacher in Los Angeles. And this is, you know, maybe it's my line of work too, but she was really exercising the skill of listening, really deep listening. I don't know, how would you describe how she succeeded, Camille?
Aaron's a great example of listening and that kind of active listening, Veronica, that I think you do, which you're a super achiever at.
Thank you.
She was an idealistic young teacher in a classroom of at-risk high school students in urban LA. And her plan to teach the kids the classics was basically going nowhere. They were putting their heads down on their desks, checking their phones, not paying any attention to her. And after a very radically charged incident in the classroom.
Racially charged
Incident, she became so upset that she challenged her students and asked them about the violence of their lives. She said, "Who of you has ever been shot?" And for the first time, the students opened up to her. They started pulling up their shirts and showing her, rolling up their pants legs and showing bullet wounds and knife wounds. And Gruel realized, like, her anger melted, and she realized that in order to reach these kids and teach them effectively, she would have to become a student of her students. And that listening was her tool to do that.
And the listening continued as she developed this program to have the kids journal about their lives. She found that teaching them about the classics that they could not relate to made no sense. But empowering them to tell their stories was so effective. And what eventually happened was the stories that these kids told were so compelling, so honest, so real, that it became a best-selling book, The Freedom Writer's Diary, that was eventually made into a movie. So from this simple act of listening of Aaron Gruel's, You had this explosion of storytelling from the children who, you know, to back up a little bit to the school that they were in, the teaching and the management of this school was pretty much just warehousing the kids. They were not getting any of that.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I mean, she set them free to tell their own stories, and she also kind of had to ditch her idea of what it meant to be a teacher in that school, you know, sitting down and teaching the classics, and she really had to look at what was in front of her, which was these kids with these crazy lives who needed an outlet just to get their own feelings out there.
Absolutely.
It was an incredibly inspiring story, and she was as proud of the fact that every one of her kids graduated as she was of the best-selling book. Hmm. And she now has gone and started a foundation which is assisting other teachers and schools to incorporate many of the techniques that she just developed on this ad hoc basis, but that she learned from listening, like, you know, what do these kids need? Let me become a student of these students so I can learn how to help them become citizens of the world.
Yeah, it's a great story. I love that. And let's go to Erica in Oconomowoc next. Hi, Erica.
Hi. I wanted to tell the story of how I got my current job. I'm working for a 90-year-old former Life magazine photographer who I saw him at maybe 10 years ago on Chicago Public Television. I said, he needs help organizing his stuff, and I'd love to work for him. And I read his autobiography at the time and then went to see him speak, and they said, a friend, somebody else said, how do I find you? He goes, look me up, I'm in the book. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's all I have to do is call him. So I called him, and I've been working for him since 2005, and it ends up, one of the great things that he taught me, and he's still shooting, he's 90, is that I can't expect other people to share my enthusiasm. And it's helped me a lot in, you know, thinking about my goals, that they're my goals. And just because somebody else doesn't have enthusiasm for them doesn't mean that they're the perfect dream for me. So.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Erica. That's such a cool story. I mean, both the initiative that she took in identifying that this is, well, kind of a kindred spirit, but also someone that she could reach out to, and believing in your own goals, too, is part of it. What do you think, Josh?
It's a wonderful story. And again, it's like she sees the guy, hears him talk, and, hey, I want to work with this guy. He says, my number's in the book. He doesn't necessarily make it easy for her. But she's not daunted by it. She goes forward and she does it. And obviously, it's a very rich experience for her, and who knows where it will lead to. And here she is around this guy who's obviously, in the same way that we got life lessons from all the people we interviewed in the book, she's getting life lessons from this fellow. And the lesson of nobody will necessarily share your enthusiasm is a great one, because, again, it says, you know, we talk a lot about the dark moments and the failure and how you're going to get through them, because that's often what happens with people when they get knocked off. And you better have a good relationship with your enthusiasm towards your goals and be able to talk yourself through, because if you can't, at some point you're going to get knocked off the path.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Erica. We appreciate it. And time for one more call, Steve in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I recently ran across some notes of a class I took, and I have just two quick points. This, I believe, was a McClellan study, and they looked at about the top 13% of people, the top 10% that were considered well-off, and the top 3% that were considered to be financially independent. And what they found was that the top 13% of these people had goals, the top 13, those group, but the top 3% that were financially independent actually had written goals. And any of the things that I'm hardly consider myself a high achiever, but of those things that I have achieved, I found that to be very true. Plus, one additional thing is that something has to spark an internal motivation in you that just drives you forward for whatever reason. You've got an interest in it or you want to learn it. I've learned some things that I thought were impossible, and I wound up writing a small book about it to explain it to others because I was so grasped by what this meant to me. And I think those two things, the plan, the written plan, and then whatever this internal motivation is that just grabs you, it pulls you forward.
Oh, that's awesome, Steve. Thank you. Written plans? Wow, that's a new one. What do you think about that, Camille?
I love that idea. Yeah, we found that these people that we talk to, I'm sure that some of them are doing that, but it's such a great opportunity to commit yourself to something that you've written it down somewhere and you can go back to it and remind yourself when you are up against those hard times.
Well, Josh and Camille, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been inspiring.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Veronica.
Thanks, Veronica.
We were just talking with Camille Sweeney, journalist, Anna McDowell Arts Colony Fellow, and Josh Gosfield, an award-winning illustrator and fine artist and former art director at New York Magazine. Together, they co-authored the book The Art of Doing, How Superachievers Do What They Do and How They Do It So Well. And I want to thank Marika Suval for producing that hour and Rana Fanning for her technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert, and there's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.